Good morning. We're delighted to welcome special guests this morning. We have students from the Berlin High School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming this morning. You may be seated. We also have students from Monticello High School. Would they please stand? We want to thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. And students are invited from across the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they do, they are given materials about the case and may engage in outside activities relating to this case. They then come to court, listen to the oral argument, and then meet with a justice after this second case. They will be joined today by students from Union Grove High School who are here for the first oral argument. And is there anyone in the audience who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear? It's easier to understand and listen to the oral argument if you have a summary. Okay. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Annette Zeger. She is the justice with whom you'll meet at lunch today. She's on my far right.
We're often confused for each other.
Because you look a lot alike.
Wow.
She's on your far left, my far right. And she's the justice with whom you'll meet. You'll discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance or substantive issues of the case we're about to hear. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left, your right, is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call our second case today. 08AP882CR, State of Wisconsin versus Mitchell Lang. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Timothy David Kiefer of the Dane County District Attorney's Office. Counsel, you may proceed. You're representing the State of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Kiefer of the Dane County DA's office. I'm representing the state of Wisconsin. I'm asking the court today to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and affirm the decision of the Dane County Circuit Court in this case. And in so doing, I'm asking this court to reaffirm its holding that's been set forth in numerous cases of this court that the standard for probable cause is totality of the circumstances, and further, that the decision on totality of the circumstances is to be made on a case-by-case basis. And that's really what this case comes down to, is reaffirming the totality of the circumstances test and reaffirming that it's to be made on a case-by-case basis, not, as the appellate court seems to suggest, on the basis of a checklist or certain things that have to be there. Rather, it really depends on the circumstances of each case. And what were those circumstances? I think this is a case where it is very fact-specific, and unlike a lot of appellate cases, it's worthwhile to really dig into the facts because it is such a fact-specific case. Whenever, in fact, you are looking at totality of the circumstances, it's very fact-specific. You have a defendant who was going initially 10 to 15 miles an hour over the 30 mile per hour speed limit. He was over the center line of the road, not just over the center line as in one lane over, he was actually two lanes over, which is to say approximately 24 feet over the line as the testimony at the suppression hearing indicated. This all was happening at about 2:52 in the morning. Very significant in that, as was testified by the officers, in that area of town, which is the Maple Bluff, the village of Maple Bluff, just outside of Madison, 2:52 in the morning is about the time of night when people who are leaving the bars in downtown Madison at around 2:30 are getting to Maple Bluff at about that time. That's according to the testimony of the Maple Bluff police officers. Then we have the defendant. When the officer puts on her lights to stop the defendant does not stop. Rather, the defendant speeds up to over 80 miles an hour, such that the officer is going at over 80 miles an hour. I believe she testified about 84 miles an hour and unable to catch up with the defendant. Then we have the defendant who, for no apparent reason, there's nothing on the roadway, it was not wet, no bad weather conditions. The defendant drives straight into a utility pole, causing the vehicle to flip over onto its hood and causing the defendant to, in fact, be thrown out of the vehicle, and he's then laying unconscious outside the vehicle at that point. When the officers come up, there is loud music that's coming out of the vehicle that's still playing from the radio, and in fact, the engine's still running and the radio's still playing. There's gasoline all over the scene. And the circuit court, I think, summarized it very well when the circuit court summarized this sequence of events as, quote, horrendous driving, unquote. That was in the findings of fact that the circuit court made. The circuit court further summarized this series of events as, quote, dramatically bad driving, unquote. And when you take this dramatically bad driving, followed by driving into the utility pole, the collision that followed that dramatically bad driving, then you put on top of that the fact that this is happening just after bar time, it becomes not just a reasonable inference, but a compelling inference that what was going on here was that the defendant was, in fact, driving while impaired.
Can I interrupt you, counsel? What was he? Was he ever arrested?
Yes.
What was he arrested for?
OWI.
OWI.
Second offense. And PAC, second offense.
Okay, but you didn't know that when the arrest was made.
I believe they knew that it was second offense.
There was an arrest. Can you arrest for first offense, which is a civil forfeiture?
I believe at that point it would be the same incident. It would be the same arrest, whether it be first offense or fifth offense.
So, is the issue in this case whether that arrest that there was probable cause for that arrest? Well, let me put the question this way. If there was probable cause to arrest him for drunk driving, then you could do the search, right, for the blood.
Correct.
Right? And in this case, the evidence of the search, that is the blood alcohol content, right?
Correct.
Content, was introduced or attempted to be introduced, right?
Correct.
And so the issue is, can you introduce that evidence, right?
Correct.
And the introduction of that evidence relies on whether the arrest was valid under probable cause.
Correct. That's how it was presented to the circuit court, yes.
Is that how you're presenting it here?
Well, we are bound by how this was brought up below and how we argued it below. I think there's certainly a hint in the appeals court ruling that there's some other ways to look at it, but there's a footnote 3, I believe, in the appellate court ruling that some other doctrines of law could come into play. But given that that's how we argued it below and how we've argued it here, because that's how the circuit court addressed it, that's how we're approaching it.
Well, how could you argue it differently?
Well, again, I'm not trying to introduce something new other than the fact that I think the court's invited it. There's certainly argument that could be made, and this would be State v. Siebel, which is, in fact, a case that was cited by the defense in their brief, that where the police reasonably suspect that the evidence of blood would contain evidence of crime under...
In that case, there was probable cause to arrest. There was an arrest, and the search was incident to the arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you arguing that this search was incident to the arrest?
Correct. The search was incident to the arrest for the OWS.
Still, then, you need probable cause to arrest for drunk driving.
True, except that we're really arguing not about the, if this is the direction we're going with, we're talking about what would be the level that's required to do that blood draw. And Siebel does seem to hold that the level to do the blood draw is not probable cause, but rather reasonable suspicion.
But there was a good arrest. That is the basis of Siebold, isn't it?
That
there was a valid arrest on probable cause. The problem with your case, as I understand it, is, maybe I don't understand it, is that the arrest is challenged on probable cause because you had nothing to clip them on drunk driving except bad driving. You didn't smell an intoxicant. You couldn't because there was gasoline, right?
Correct.
You had nothing else that tied him to drunk driving. You don't know whether he fell asleep and did this.
Well, actually,
you don't know
if
there was a malfunction of the car that caused this.
I would like to address both of those points.
Okay.
I don't think that either of those inferences matches up with one extremely important fact in this case, which is that the defendant was initially observed driving roughly 40 to 45 miles an hour in a 30 zone. But then after the officer turned on her lights, after the officer attempted to pull the defendant over, at that point, as the testimony in the hearing showed, the defendant instead sped up to over 80 miles an hour. Now, if you're going on the scenario, this is someone who had a seizure, heart attack, whatever, how does that fit with someone who, when the officer's lights turn on, that person actually speeds up? That doesn't really fit with someone who's an unconscious person who's passed out at the wheel and their foot, you know, depresses on the accelerator. You would expect someone like that to be traveling at a relatively constant rate until they hit something. That inference doesn't square with the speeding up, dramatically speeding up from roughly 40 to 45 miles an hour to somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 miles an hour. That's a dramatic difference in the speed, and that's not explainable by these alternative inferences.
In Siebold, though there was probable cause to arrest, it wasn't an arrest for OMBWI, was it?
No, it's my understanding it was, I believe it was OWI homicide that was in play at Siebel. It was certainly not OWI second. It was, correct, a different charge.
A different charge. Now, if there was certainly probable cause to arrest him, in this case, for speeding, going 80 miles an hour in a residential area, but that wasn't what he was arrested for, does that in any way give support to doing the blood draw based on reasonable suspicion of OMBWI?
Absolutely. And again, this is not the direction we went in the circuit court and not something we've argued below. But since the court's raised it, I think that the case I would point to is State v. Sykes. And that's a case that holds that when there's PC probable cause to arrest for crime number one, that allows a search, and then you may in fact be charged on crime number two. In Sykes, you had a situation where the person had, there's probable cause to arrest for criminal trespass, then there is a search, and there is cocaine found, and in fact the arrest and the charge was for possession of cocaine. Here, there certainly would have been probable cause on these facts for eluding, which is a felony charge, probable cause for reckless driving. That was not the what the officer at that time subjectively decided to make the arrest for, but given that probable cause is an objective standard, I don't know that that really matters that much. And certainly that is a way that you could get there.
Well, Mr. Kiefer, let me ask it this way. Are we bound by the reasons given by the officer for arrest? The officer is apparently arrested for OWI. Are we bound by those reasons?
That's not my understanding of the law, no. My understanding is that probable cause is an objective standard. The only subjective limitation of it is it depends on the information that was known to the officer at the time. So obviously the officer didn't know what the blood alcohol was, for example. But all the facts that were within the universe of knowledge that officer has, the court can assess, and the court may put emphasis on factors that the officer didn't in making the officer's subjective determination. And in fact, I may have, during our suppression hearing where I was representing the state, I did ask the officers, what were the factors that you brought in in making that decision as a way of summarizing the testimony? But the court, neither the circuit court nor this court, is bound by the reasons that the officer gave.
Do you have any case that you can cite to us that supports that approach?
I could certainly send one to you. I could do it as a letter brief to the court if the court thinks that would be helpful.
But you don't have anything you can cite today. Sykes is a little bit different. I know you talked about Sykes before, but that's
right.
A little bit different.
I believe there's something in the brief that talks about that it being an objective. It's an object. This is actually, it is in my brief. On page 6, the bottom of page 6, States v. Coots, in determining whether there's probable cause, the court applies an objective standard. And so that supports what I'm saying, States v. Coots, that it's not the subjective determination of the officer. You're not essentially looking at what the officer was giving as the reasons either that night or when this question about the suppression hearing, but rather an objective standard, looking at all the circumstances, all the information available to the officer. So State v. Coots, 2003, Wisconsin Appeals 205.
And the objective standard that you're referring to would be the court reviewing the facts as they appear and determining what a reasonable officer under the same or similar circumstances could have determined.
Correct. That would be, and taking into account the officer's training and experience, and we did have testimony about that. There were actually two officers, and I acknowledge that there's been the point made that one of the officers was relatively new, but she consulted with another officer who was also a witness to some of the driving, who was very experienced and had about 100 OWI arrests under his belt. And so that training experience is also something that can be taken into account. For example, their knowledge as Maple Bluff officers that 2:52, which is a little after the 2:30 bar time, is a time when people who are drunk oftentimes are driving through Maple Bluff. That's knowledge that they have from their specific training experience that you or I may not have, but they have because they're Maple Bluff police officers. So getting back to the what I was saying before about the inferences to be drawn by the officers, I had previously talked about why the inference that there was a medical issue would not be a reasonable inference in our view. In fact, the only reasonable inference to be drawn from these facts was that Lane was impaired. By the way, we don't need to, under the case law, rule out every other inference, so long as we do have a reasonable inference that does support probable cause. Nevertheless, under these facts, it's hard to look at any other inference that really makes sense with these facts, other than that he was impaired in some way.
If that arrest was valid, you don't need probable cause to show he's impaired. To do the search, you only need reasonable suspicion.
That would be our view of Siebel, certainly. If you have the probable cause for an arrest.
Right. No, well, that's the issue, really, in this case, as I see it. If you have probable cause where an arrest is made,
right,
a particular charge, do you need probable cause for the arrest on that charge using the objective standard? Or if there was any other reason that an arrest could have been made, is that good enough? I mean, that's, in effect, the question that I started to ask, the question that Justice Rolinsek asked, the same question that Justice Crooks asked. Because it's questionable whether there was probable cause to arrest for intoxication. Your position is that there is probable cause. I understand that. But if the court doesn't buy your position, there clearly was good reason to arrest him for driving too fast under the conditions, for violating the speeding law. Can you arrest for that?
I would suggest that a better way to do it would be arrest, for example, for eluding based on speeding up at the time of that. Whether you can actually be arrested for speeding, that's a good question. I just don't know.
Okay. So you have to find, you're looking for a crime, a misdemeanor, a felony.
Correct.
That's evident, and that is that he didn't stop and sped up, therefore it's eluding, obstructing justice, resisting the officer. Is that the statute you're talking about?
Well, fleeing from an officer could be charged as obstructing. I think typically when someone's in a vehicle, we typically charge it out as eluding, but I don't know that you couldn't charge it as obstructing.
So your position is that because there was probable cause for that crime, which is really quite evident, or at least probable cause is probably good enough, with the conviction is another issue, then that was good enough and therefore reasonable suspicion of intoxication.
That's our backup position. Our primary position, as you already had noted, is that there was in fact probable cause for the OWI arrest. But if that position is not something the court finds persuasive, our backup position is exactly that. So long as there's PC for N arrest, this goes back to State v. Sykes, then from there, that justifies the search for evidence that relates to that crime. And certainly on an eluding charge, evidence of the blood alcohol is relevant to show that. That would be evidence that the state could then use to rebut a lot of potential defenses on an eluding charge. Certainly would be relevant to a reckless driving charge, would be relevant to a lot of other charges besides OWI. Certainly when you do a blood draw looking for alcohol, the first thing that comes to mind is this is going to be evidence of drunk driving, but there are other charges that blood alcohol could be relevant to.
Could I ask you, this crash occurred on Sherman Avenue?
Correct.
And there were two officers there?
Correct.
And you say the arrest was made for OWI?
Correct.
Was a ticket written out?
Was a what?
A ticket written out, or?
I believe a ticket was written out at that time.
Written out right on Sherman Avenue?
I doubt it, because if the scene was a somewhat chaotic scene, as is set forth in the complaint, there was the issue of the car potentially going to explode because of the gasoline that was suffusing the scene. So whether that ticket was written out at the scene or whether it was written out at some distance from the scene, maybe at the hospital, that I just don't think that's reflected in the record one way or the other. But as the officers had said, their priority at that time was saving the defendant's life, not investigating OWI or writing out a ticket.
What I'm really trying to get at is... this was in a second offense, drunk driving.
Correct.
Was there any time prior to the time that the blood draw occurred that the officers knew this was a second offense, drunk driving?
I think the record is silent on that point, but I don't believe there's any evidence that the officers knew that this was second offense. That's my understanding of it.
But I assume they knew the defendant's name.
Given the whole situation, their contact with him was pretty limited due to the fact of his medical condition. When they found out his name, I assume that happened at some point at the hospital. But again, this was a very unusual situation. It's not your typical situation where you hand over your license. This is a situation where the officers actually had extremely limited ability to have contact with the defendant because he was taken to the hospital pretty much immediately due to his severe injuries.
Your opposing counsel, what is your opposing counsel's position on what this driving entailed other than drunk driving?
Well, going to find that out in a couple minutes, but I don't want to characterize his argument, but certainly I think it's hard to see this as anything but at least probable cause for OWI. And again, if for some reason that's not persuasive, there certainly is probable cause for eluding, reckless driving, etc. And remember, OWI, and I think this is an important point to make, OWI is not just alcohol. There's this thing of, well, you know, there wasn't an odor of intoxicants. That's a big thing. It wasn't an empty beer can. Remember, prescription drugs or street drugs can also give rise to an OWI. And with someone who is on prescription drugs or street drugs, there's not going to be any odor, typically, for most drugs. There's not going to be empty containers for most of those situations. And that's why I think it's important for the court, because obviously this is going to be statewide precedent for years to come, to recognize that this case, even though it happened in this case to, in fact, be OWI alcohol, they found out later, this could just as easily have been OWI based on prescription drugs. And the precedent of saying, well, there has to be this odor of intox, there has to be empty containers, there has to be field sobriety tests, that's, I think, a dangerous precedent to set because it really impairs the ability of police to act on prescription drug cases.
Counsel, of what import is the law of implied consent? There are specific provisions in 343.305 that deal with what law enforcement can do in requesting a test under AR on 343.305(3)(AR). If the person is an operator of a vehicle that's involved in an accident that causes death or great bodily harm to any person, and a law enforcement officer detects the presence of alcohol or controlled substance, it goes on to list those, then they can order a test, and they're presumed to have consented. If a person is unconscious, that's on sub B, they are presumed to have not withdrawn their consent, that is to consent, to have consented to administration of tests. And it says, if a law enforcement officer has probable cause to believe that a person violated 346.63, this OWI, or detects the presence of alcohol or controlled substance. So it's in the disjunctive. In that, it says if you have a person who's unconscious, first of all, we're going to treat them as though they've consented to the administration of a test. And if you find that there's probable cause for violation of OWI or the presence of alcohol or controlled substance or such and such, then you can administer the test. What import, if any, does this language regarding the implied consent law have to this case?
Well, my time is up. Do you want me to answer now? Or?
Yes, we
okay.
Do.
Well, I think potentially it certainly does come into play in this case. We do have someone who is unconscious at the time. The evidence of alcohol specifically has always been the weakness in this case, quite frankly, because of the unusual circumstances of the case. The part about the great bodily harm, we've certainly looked at that. There was great bodily harm that was caused to the driver of the car, and that may come into play in the future in this case. But I think that the import is such that if we can use it, we certainly would want to use it. And the fact of the driver being unconscious and gives all the unusual circumstances of this case, it does take it outside the realm of your typical implied consent situation. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Stephen Cohn representing Mitchell Lang.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Attorney Steve Cohn, and I represent Mitchell Lang. This morning I'm asking this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. I believe it was correct. And from what I've heard so far, I believe that the issue has been correctly stated, and that is whether or not there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Lang for drunk driving. I believe my opponent, Mr. Kiefer, has correctly articulated the standard, and that is the totality of the circumstances standard. But he has only articulated part of the circumstances. He has failed to tell you the totality of the circumstances. The totality of the circumstances includes the fact that there was an active investigation, an affirmative investigation by two police officers at the scene. All the way up to arrest, there was an officer investigating the case. And the officers were unable to find an odor of alcohol. They did not get any statements indicating that there was drinking, a statement from Mr. Lane or a statement from another witness.
When was the arrest actually made, and how was it made? I mean, the guy's unconscious. He was transported to the hospital, I assume.
Yes, ma'am.
So how was he arrested?
I believe he was arrested at the scene. That's my understanding.
So when he was transported, he was a prisoner of the state?
That is my understanding, ma'am.
Did he have a guard?
At the hospital?
Yeah.
I do not know.
Thank you.
And so there were no containers of alcohol at the scene. There was basically nothing that connected Mr. Lang to impairment by intoxicants or even the use of intoxicants. And that is the totality of the circumstances.
Counselor, it was represented by opposing counsel that we shouldn't be too concerned about the lack of the odor of intoxicants or the lack of a beer whiskey container, because he could still violate the statute if he were intoxicated on prescription drugs or street drugs. Can you respond to that argument, please?
Yes, ma'am. I'm not saying that there needs to be any one particular aspect of proof. I'm not saying there needs to be an odor of alcohol or a container. What I'm saying is there needs to be some proof. Now, if he was abusing marijuana, let's say, there would still be an odor.
What if it was just a prescription drug? He took too much Valium.
That could also happen.
How would you know? What would be the indicia of taking too much Valium?
There could be certainly a prescription pill bottle in the vehicle. If there is, I guess, no proof, then there's a problem. And I don't think the officers can then arrest. I think they need some proof of use of intoxicants.
Do you know if the ticket, usually the tickets say OMBWI and they say alcohol or they say drugs, generally on the ticket. And I haven't seen it. Do you know what it said on the ticket, his arrest ticket?
Well, in this case, I believe his blood was only tested for alcohol. And I don't recall specifically what the ticket says. From my experience, it doesn't usually say alcohol specifically.
Okay, well, it's been a while since I've looked at one. There used to be a form where you could check, but that's fine. Thank you. Well, the ticket says description of violation, OMUWI second offense. Now that's have been dated after the accident.
Yes, ma'am.
Could I just ask, Mr. Kiefer set out a number of factors based on facts. Is it unreasonable for anyone here? Is it unreasonable for someone listening to all of those facts to draw the inference that this driver was impaired and was either drinking or taking some kind of drugs?
Yes, sir. Thank you for asking that. I think that the fact that there was a crash, an erratic driving is somewhat vague in meaning by itself. What takes on added significance is the fact that there was an investigation and there was no indication of drinking. There was no indication of drug use. There was no indication of impairment. That's the importance of taking the totality of the circumstances into consideration. With that additional facts, I think it's very reasonable and most reasonable to say, I'm not sure what's going on here. I think the question is, why did the crash occur? Why did it occur? Was it because of negligence? Was it because of recklessness? Was the driver fatigued? Maybe the driver did fall asleep. That's very reasonable. It's very early in the morning. Was there a medical problem? Did he have a seizure? A stroke? All these things are very possible. Was it a suicide attempt? I had a client that actually did crash her car on purpose to try and attempt suicide. Perhaps he had just committed a burglary, and he's going, as the facts indicate, 10 or 15 miles over the speed limit, and then he sees an officer pull behind him. With his guilty conscience, hey, I just pulled off a burglary, and now there's a police officer following me. I got to escape. I got to lose that cop. That could have been going on, too. It's a very vague circumstances. Just because there's a crash does not mean he was impaired.
Well, let me ask this. It's a little hard to accept the option of falling asleep, but let's accept all of the other ones. Is it still unreasonable for a person on these facts to reasonably suspect, and almost think there's a probability that this driver is impaired because of something that the driver consumed?
I think what I would characterize that would be as a jump to a conclusion. I would characterize that kind of thinking as jumping to a conclusion or thinking on a hunch, but it's not based on the evidence. There should be some evidence of actual impairment or use of intoxicants. Without anything, there's a big hole. The heart of drunk driving is that the person was drunk or impaired by alcohol or drugs. There's not a shred of such evidence, and without that, I don't think it would be reasonable to say that's probably what happened. I think that would be a hunch. That's how I would say.
Counsel, what about the fact that your client could have been arrested for fleeing or eluding?
You're asking me what if he had been arrested?
No, I'm just saying, what about the fact that there's probable cause for fleeing or eluding? That's a felony.
Well, I may not agree with that premise at all. I think fleeing or eluding has to involve proof that he knew he was being pulled over. I'm not sure that the evidence is that clear.
Okay, all I can tell you is I've seen hundreds of fleeing or eluding cases, and if you've got the lights on and you're following the vehicle and you've got the wigwags on and you have a siren, you can have a number of those things, and the person then speeds up to 84 miles an hour, there's going to be probable cause and a complaint for that to proceed forward and for there to be a prelim or whatever. So at least in my world,
yes, ma'am,
that's enough. So assuming that that's enough, what, if any, impact does that have on your analysis?
I don't think that it's relevant. I think maybe the state should have proceeded that way and charged him with those things, but if he was eluding, they wouldn't be able to take his blood, because the whole idea of being able to take a blood sample is that there's evidence of the crime within it. And what evidence could you find of eluding within your blood?
I almost hear you saying that if you're going to drive drunk, make sure you really go big, because you need to have an accident, and if it's really bad and there's a gasoline smell and someone's almost dying, that you're not going to be able to really be arrested unless they can smell alcohol or see beer cans or something like that in the car. That's the standard that you're asking this court to accept today, I think.
Well, ma'am, I believe that the court should be sending a message not to drink and drive at all. I don't think we'd be setting a policy that would encourage people to have accidents. I think that that's not likely. People, I think, would not purposefully risk their lives just to get out of a drunk driving ticket.
Of course not. You know, the fact is there are a lot of tragic cases that end up in court. And most of the time, people don't intend the consequences that happen. But oftentimes, what you have is someone who is seriously injured or someone who kills someone else. And then counsel can come in and say, there's a defense to this. This accident would have happened anyway. This accident had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, I was intoxicated. This accident had to do with the icy conditions or the person coming into my lane or the whatever it might have been. That's a defense that you offer at a trial, and you can proceed on that. But it's almost like you're asking this court to assume as a matter of law that if a defense exists, someone cannot be arrested, and an officer can't use their common sense and good judgment.
What I'm saying is that we all have rights. Even the guilty have rights, the innocent have rights, and the rights of all of us is to be free from arrest without probable cause. And what I'm saying is there is no probable cause here. And I'm also saying I don't even think there's reasonable suspicion that he consumed alcohol or had intoxicants or was impaired. I think there's probable cause for other crimes, yes, but not that.
Mr. Cohen, I'd like to go back to the primary argument of the parties in regard to the probable cause for the OWI. And it seemed to me a few minutes ago you were listing out some of the factors of the totality of the circumstances and then offered the conclusion that doesn't constitute probable cause. And now I think you've just added it doesn't amount to reasonable articulable suspicion. Doesn't that analysis discount or even ignore the fairly substantial body of case law indicating that officers are allowed in making that determination to employ reasonable inferences from the facts and circumstances? And some of those do include, they've been recited in the briefs, your opposing counsel made reference, the lane deviation. I remember reading briefs 24 feet, but it was something, it was wider in your opposing counsel's recitation. The fact that the officers knew that it was shortly after bar time. Aren't these things that the officers could use to make reasonable inferences?
Yes, thank you. I think, of course, reasonable inferences are made every day and when police do their work, and that's the law, that's as it should be. But when you look at the low standard of reasonable suspicion, that is articulated in the case law as having specific, articulable facts and then go from there to make reasonable inferences. I think we're starting with an assumption that everybody coming home from a bar is drunk, which I don't think that's called for. So just being on the road around bar time, I don't think really leads
to... You use the plural pronoun. That's not my assumption, but go ahead.
Yes, sir. But I think what I'm looking for is the fact of if there were an odor, that itself does not prove impairment. That is the proof where you thereby take a reasonable inference from that. So that's the starting point, and I think it would be reasonable then if there were some proof of alcohol consumption, because consumption isn't necessarily impairment, but if you had consumption coupled with the fact of erratic driving and the bar time, then I think you've got something. Because then you can then infer, well, if he had alcohol, maybe he had enough to be impaired. But if you don't even have any proof of alcohol consumption or intoxicant consumption, you don't even get out of the starting gate. There's nothing to take an inference from. So I think...
Okay, and that goes back to your response to Justice Rogensack's questions in regard to the prescription pill bottle. Some kind of... You're suggesting... In your argument is that there needs to be a direct nexus to some kind of intoxicant.
I wouldn't exactly phrase it that way. I wouldn't say direct nexus. I would say there has to be some proof of consumption. Some proof. It doesn't have to necessarily be direct. It depends how you define direct. But say having a can of, say 12 cans of empty beer cans in the car, well, that's not direct at all. I mean, he could have had them last week. But it's some proof. It does get you closer between that nexus between, you know, an intoxicant and the defendant.
Mr. Cohn, if there was no probable cause, let's assume your argument is correct, for an arrest on drunk driving, wasn't there probable cause to arrest on a different charge?
He may in fact have.
Yeah. So, assume that there was probable cause to arrest on a different charge, not the arrest given. Isn't that good enough then for reasonable suspicion to do a blood test?
Well,
in other words, can you switch the arrest charge?
That may be theoretically possible. I don't think that's the situation here, because what we have is one arrest for OWI.
Understand that.
And if that arrest wasn't valid, there was never any other subsequent arrest.
I understand that. But can't the court say, well, he could have arrested on a different charge. We're not bound by his subjective determination of what the charge is. If you had a good enough probable cause charge to arrest, you can arrest. Arrest was good, and there was reasonable suspicion here on alcohol. You probably concede there was reasonable suspicion on alcohol.
No, ma'am.
Okay, I'll concede for you. There was reasonable suspicion.
Okay.
On alcohol, I mean, I understand why you won't, because you want it either way, but the test would be for reasonable suspicion, not probable cause for alcohol on the search.
Yes, ma'am. I think you're referring to the Sykes case that was cited.
Not only the Sykes, there are other cases.
Well, in that particular case, the officer.
I want to know, can you arrest on charge one that no, the court finds no probable cause? The court thinks there was probable cause to arrest on a different charge. Is that good enough for getting blood?
I think at some point you have to have a valid arrest.
Okay.
And so I think he could have been arrested later maybe, but he was never arrested on anything.
Now, let me just go through Ms. Hoffman's written statement. According to this statement, they put your client into the, transported into the UW emergency room. On his arrival, there were multiple doctors working on him. Then Ms. Hoffman found Lang's driver license at the nurse's station, and then she knew his name. So based on his excessive speed, this is what she says, crossing over the line, etc., his inability to stay control, the time of a night, I determined I would be charging him with operating a motor vehicle while under the influence. Then it says that she found out that he had a prior conviction. Then she said that she asked for blood, and the nurse said, we gotta get him to get tests. He's still unconscious, a CT, etc. When after he gets the CT, she asks again for blood, she being the officer. And he was unconscious. He was frantically being worked on by medical personnel, and so the officer told him, Lang, that he was under arrest. This is why he's unconscious. For operating motor vehicle while under the influence. I read the informing the accused form to Lang verbatim. And this is the form that Justice Bradley was in the statute talking about. Under the implied consent law, she writes, and based on the fact that exigent circumstances exist for the recovery of blood evidence, due to the fact that a second offense, OMWI, is a criminal offense, I had Nurse Barb prepare to draw the required amount. So they didn't arrest him until he was in the hospital.
Okay.
They arrested him when he was unconscious, and they arrested him specifically for driving under the influence of alcohol. After the arrest was made, they drew blood. That's the sequence of all of this, and they filled out the citation form and gave it to him with a return date of 3:01. Do you agree that that's the facts?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So there was a specific charge for arrest. He was so advised under the informed consent.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any cases that support your theory that if there was a valid, that there could have been a valid arrest on a different charge, it's good enough to do a search?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Do you have any cases that support your position that if there could have been a valid arrest on a different charge, that's not good enough to support a search?
Well, I think there's a whole line of cases that deal with that. Again, as Mr. Kiefer stated, that is not the issue before the court. That was never briefed. That was not brought up in the trial court or the Court of Appeals either.
Counsel, let's look at what the statute says, the language of the statute. This is a follow-up to what the informed consent.
The informed consent. And I know you folks didn't argue or advance this, or at least I didn't see it, but I don't know why it doesn't either A, control some of this discussion, or B, at least inform it. It says under 343.305(3)(b), and it sets forth what you do when you have a person who's unconscious. And this is dealing with administering the implied consent law. And it says, and I'm paraphrasing, hopefully I'm being true to the statute when I paraphrase it, look, it doesn't start out with look, I'm just saying, look. If you have a person who's unconscious, as a matter of law, we're going to say they've consented. Then it continues. And if a law enforcement officer has probable cause to believe that a person has violated 346.63, doesn't say, 340.08 or 342.21, it says 346.63.1, 2M, or some other local ordinance. So if a law enforcement officer has probable cause to believe that a person has violated OWI, or if that law enforcement officer detects any presence of alcohol, then a test can be ordered, even though the person is unconscious or under that circumstance. So you can order a test for an unconscious person under the statute, if there's probable cause to believe a violation of 343.663, or you detect any presence of alcohol.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, reading that comes to mind, you must not need to be able to detect any presence of alcohol involved in the probable cause determination, otherwise there wouldn't be a disjunctive. You need either probable cause to believe there's a violation of the drunk driving law, or the officer needs to detect any presence of alcohol, controlled substance, etc. Then you can administer the test. So that the inference to me is that you can have probable cause to believe a violation without detecting any presence of alcohol under that statute. Can you respond to that? Maybe that's unfair, counsel, because you don't have it in front of you and maybe haven't thought about it. But if you're able to, I'd like you to respond.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. What the statute says is basically consistent with what we're talking about here. It's the probable cause portion.
That's right.
I think the facts are really undisputed that there was no presence of alcohol found at the...
But when you have the disjunctive, it sounds to me like you don't need it.
And neither am I saying that you do. As I mentioned to Justice Gableman, I'm not saying you need any particular proof, just some proof. I'm not saying you need an odor of alcohol or you need an empty beer can, but you need something that would indicate the use of intoxicants, because that is the heart of drunk driving. Without that, you cannot have a drunk driving case.
I think your argument really resonates with me, but for this language, because it's in the disjunctive. You need probable cause to believe that there's an OWI violation or any presence of alcohol, which would be on the breath or containers. So since it's in the disjunctive, it suggests to me that for probable cause to believe there's a violation of OWI, you don't have to have anything dealing with alcohol. No breath of alcohol, no containers of alcohol. You can, but you don't have to.
I understand that, but what you can have is some proof of use of alcohol without having the actual alcohol present. You could have, for instance, an admission from a person. Well, that particular statute
this deals with the unconscious, and that's what we have here. Unconscious, not only at the scene, all the way through the hospital, unconscious at the time of arrest.
Yes, ma'am. But you can have witness statements that, you know, this could be a passenger in the car that could provide some information. I think the statute is trying to cover all bases because it is very important to, you know, be able to prosecute drunk drivers. So they want to make it broad, and I understand that. But I still think that this case does not fall, you know, does not get tangled up in that language. I think there is neither. I think there is not probable cause, and I think there was no presence of alcohol. So I think we're okay under the statute.
Are you suggesting at all that the Maple Bluff police officers didn't do a very good job?
I think they could have done more. I'll state it that way, because there really is no evidence in the record that they actually had went to Mr. Lang at the hospital. Okay, they know Mr. Lang was there at the hospital and the officers were there, but they didn't go and they could have smelled his breath. You know, even if he'd be unconscious, they could have tried to detect some evidence of alcohol usage by smelling him. Alcohol can come out of the pores, it comes out of your breath. You can smell it when someone's been consuming it. They could have also waited around till he did regain consciousness. Obviously, he did regain consciousness at some point. They could have just asked him. He could have made incriminating admissions, and that's very common in drunk driving cases, where people say, yeah, you know, I was coming from the bar and I had this much to drink. That's very common. And so they could have done more, and if they had, then there may not have been any questions. So part of the reason there's this large hole is because they didn't go that extra step, which they could have.
District Cohen, let me throw something else into the mix. And this is a follow-through to what the Chief was asking, and especially Justice Bradley as well. 346.631A says, a person who is unconscious or otherwise incapacitated is presumed not to have withdrawn his consent. Is that not significant in all of this, too? In other words, you've got the implied consent law, which means you've given consent, and you've got a situation that seems to run very similar to the situation your client was in. And the statute says, person unconscious, otherwise incapacitated, is presumed not to have withdrawn his consent. Isn't that significant as you look at the questions, especially the Chief and Justice Bradley were asking?
Yes, sir. I agree that Mr. Lang was presumed to not have withdrawn consent, but that goes back to what Justice Bradley was saying. That language about being unconscious, you still need the probable cause, or you need some evidence of alcohol use before you can actually proceed.
And the only evidence of alcohol use here is his driving.
I would disagree with that premise. I would say that there was bad driving, for certain. What the cause of that was at the time, given the officer's knowledge. I don't think they could assume that.
You're objecting to the inference that bad driving means the presence of alcohol.
Yes, ma'am.
Some of us are bad drivers without alcohol.
I see my time is up.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cohn? Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
I want to jump off from something that Justice Prosser had said a few minutes ago about what, and I asked this question for the court to think about, what should the Maple Bluff police officers have done in this situation? And I think it's not just an academic question, because obviously this court is going to be providing guidance to future officers in similar fact situations. And I think...
Well, why couldn't they smell its breath? We're dealing with a couple of hours after the accident. There's no gasoline. Maybe he's permeated his clothes, which are probably off now. So why didn't they smell his breath?
Well, for one thing, their access to him was quite limited due to the fact that he's being worked on frantically by the medical personnel.
They asked the nurse, did you smell alcohol? I mean, they could have asked the nurse.
Sure. It's possible that they could have done that. And I think what you have here is officers who are doing the best that they could at the time, given all the other evidence, OWI. They didn't take that step.
Bad driving evidence.
Yeah, the bad driving. Actually, the circuit court didn't characterize his bad driving. The court... Horrendous driving, dramatically bad driving, plus that driving happening at 2:52 in the morning.
Now, well, we've also said it at 9 o'clock is a bad time, too. You can suspect them of drunk driving. I've decided that you can have a drunk driver any time of day or night.
Well, State v. Post, which was the case I talked about, 9 o'clock at night. There's also case law, which I cite in my briefs, talking about how when it's at bar time, that takes on special significance. Certainly, 9 o'clock in the morning or 2:30 in the afternoon is different from later in the evening. But when it's happening right after bar time, that takes on some very particular significance. And again, to ask yourself, rather than us 2 years after the fact second-guessing the officers, here you have officers who, in that situation, which was a very chaotic situation, that did the best job they could, who had the very limited ability to have contact with the driver. And the question is, well, what would the court want the officers to do? One option would be, well, we're going to wait until the defendant is conscious and we can question him about drunk driving before we make any sort of arrest. Well, at that point, which could have been sometime later, the key evidence, which was the alcohol in the blood, would have dissipated. That alcohol in someone's blood is a unique sort of evidence in that it goes away within a matter of hours. And so that's why time was of such the essence for the officers. I agree with what Justice Bradley had said, and it's a somewhat complex argument, but has a lot of force, that when you have the statute put in the disjunctive, either probable cause for OWI or any presence of alcohol, either one of those is enough. So to say you need to have probable cause for OWI that would justify taking the blood means you also have to have evidence, direct evidence of the presence of alcohol. That really does go against the statute. And admittedly, that was not an issue that had come up before today, but it's certainly an argument that has a lot of force. I would like to talk about this idea, well, if this were a prescription drug case, well, we should, the officers, in a hypothetical future case that's of similar facts but involving prescription drugs, unless there's a prescription pill bottle that's found in the vehicle, the suggestion would be in a future case on these facts that's prescription drugs, the person gets a free pass. Unless you happen to find that prescription drug bottle that's underneath the car that's flipped over and is potentially going to catch on fire. And I think that leads back to what Justice Ziegler had said earlier, that it creates this perverse situation where the more aggravated your driving, the more extreme the driving is, the easier it is, ironically, that you're not going to get convicted. And that sets up a, I'm not saying that creates incentives for people intentionally drive badly, but it does set up a situation where the worse you drive, the less likely it is that you get convicted. And in fact, I think that's true in this case. If he had actually pulled over when he had been pulled over, rather than speeding up to 80 miles an hour and driving into a telephone pole, surely he would have been convicted. But for the fact of his extremely bad driving and the subsequent medical crisis that resulted from that, we're here today. And that goes back to my first point, which is, again, what would we want the officers to do in this situation? What is the message the court wants to send officers in this situation? I don't think that message should be you have to wait until the defendant is sober or, well, woken up, which would be, by that point they would probably be sober, so you can question them and that sort of thing. And I know that my time is up, and therefore I will stop and ask that the court consider what message do we want to send law enforcement in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Kiefer, and thank you, Mr. Cohn, for your arguments in yet another probable cause search case, which we have many each year. That ends our hearing on 08-AP-882-CR, State of Wisconsin versus Lang. The court is in recess until 1:30, when we will hear our third case today, and the students should remain, and Justice Ziegler will be out to talk with them.